I am Plant on the Line. This is thecommentary.ca. Pierre Burton was the most famous Canadian media figure of his time. He appeared in newspapers and magazines, on radio and television, and his books not only occupy the shelves of many Canadians, but also are a legendary part of the book industry in this country for the past 50 or more years. John Hazlitt Cuff once wrote of Burton that he is so aggressively ubiquitous, the tendency is to yawn when his name comes up. He is the subject of a new book, the first biography, simply titled Pierre Burton, A Biography. Its author, the historian A.B. MacKillop, joins me now. With tremendous research and readable storytelling, he charts the life and times of Burton. In doing so, he also gives us a view of the country in those years that Burton was active, and more importantly, provides a sense of what Burton meant to the country he so prodigiously wrote about. A.B. MacKillop is the Chancellor's Professor and Chair of the Department of History at Carleton University. His previous book, The Spinster and the Prophet, was shortlisted for the Governor General's Award and the Charles Taylor Prize, and won the Arthur Ellis Award for Best Nonfiction, among other awards. He lives in Ottawa, but joins me here in Vancouver. The book is published by McClelland & Stewart and retails for $37.99. Please welcome to the Plant on the Line program, Brian MacKillop. Good morning, Professor MacKillop.
Good morning, Joe.
Thanks for joining us.
My pleasure.
One of the things, among other things, one of the things that this book is remarkable at is that it's a wonderful primer of the book industry. I have authors on from time to time, and it's always interesting to hear what they go through to get a book published, and you do that in terms of Burton's career. What should we take from the fact that the book, that this biography is published by McClelland & Stewart? He was published there often throughout his career, but he didn't end his career there, right?
No, he didn't.
And was it quite acrimonious from what I understand?
It was not a pleasant ending, no. There were problems on, I think, on both sides. The book industry had changed a good deal in the 1990s, and Burton's titles weren't selling as well as they had been. This was after all the dawning of the big box store and the importation of vast numbers of American and international authors. So there was a huge competition. So when he was asked to, or when he decided to write the second volume of his memoirs, which came to be called My Times, he was offered an advance that was significantly under what he normally would have received. And from their point of view, McClellan and Stewart didn't like paying a big advance for somebody whose sales seemed to be in decline.
Now, how did this book come about in terms of getting published by M&S?
Well, it's interesting. I published The Spinster and the Prophet, my previous book, with a small company, McFarlane, Walter & Ross. And it went out of business just about 2000 or 2001, and my contract devolved to McClellan & Stewart. McClellan & Stewart actually had handled the marketing and the distribution of the first book, so I had a working relationship with the company. But M&S wasn't my choice. It was circumstances that had me being published by them.
Did they have anything to say about what you wrote about them? I mean, some of the people are still there, aren't they?
Yes, some of them are. Not a lot. But Avi Bennett is still alive. He was a publisher during those years. And Doug Gibson, who has his own imprint at M&S, is still there. So there are some people. I haven't had any contact about the contents of the book, at least as it applies to M&S, from them. They may be speaking in the corridors, because their role is a bit ambiguous in the final years with Burton.
At dinner last night, I mentioned that I was to speak with you today, and someone asked who would have been Burton's American counterpart, because he was so prodigious and so as I said, as Cuff says in your book, you quote Cuff, he was so ubiquitous.
Well, and he was everyone kept saying he was overexposed at certain points, but it never worked to his disadvantage. To answer your question, I searched a long while trying to find an answer to exactly that question of who, either in the United States or in England, was the sort of counterpart to Burton, who commanded all of the media in a way that he did. And I wasn't able to find anyone, frankly. You know, here's a man who starts out as a newspaper man and is city editor, you know, by the time he's 21, of a Vancouver paper, the News Herald. He goes on to McLean's magazine, becomes managing editor of that, but within 7 or 8 years of going there in the late 40s. He is on TV within the first 2 weeks of national broadcasting, and he goes on from there. You know, he of course, dominates the book industry for about 30 years. And the question, though, I suppose have said he also had his own radio program that broadcast him for 5 minutes every day, 11 times a day. The remarkable thing isn't that he commanded each of these, it's that for a long time, particularly in the 60s through the early 80s, he was doing everything at once. There was almost nowhere you could go, no media you could subject yourself to and not encounter him. And I haven't found anyone in the States. You know, there's a little bit of Garrison Keillor in him in the way he's sort of folksy. There's a little bit of some of the great war reporters like Edward R. Murrow, because he was himself a war reporter for the Korean War. There's, you know, something of the popular historian, of course, in him, so that makes him a little bit like Studs Terkel. There are various people in the States who you can link him to, but it takes about 6 or 8 of those people to come up with one Burton. It's quite amazing.
There were a couple of things in the book about his early life, and you go through his early life a great deal, and I suggest people pick up the book simply for that, among other things. You talk about them living in Oak Bay, and yeah. He made up his own version of Monopoly because they couldn't afford it.
That's right.
Where did you find that fact?
I believe that probably was mentioned in probably the first volume of his memoirs. But he also wrote for 5 years or so in the late 50s, early 60s, a column in the Toronto Star. And every once in a while, he would turn to old moments in his life, his early life. And he would talk about that sort of nostalgic sort of thing. He wrote a good deal about himself, of course, and that was part of the problem I had in writing the biography. What new was there to say about a man?
As a biographer, because he'd written so much about himself, was it easier to sort of piece his life together for this book?
Well, it was easy to get a kind of chronology together, the basic things. But what I had to do was to strip away his approach, which is kind of a life as anecdote, and actually sort of get to the more basic things about his life. What drove him? What made him so popular? Things like that, and of course, I needed something to say that he hadn't said himself, and I think I got along that track early on when I discovered something about his father, which nobody in the Burton family knew, and that took me in a whole interpretive direction that Burton himself couldn't have taken.
And you told him that before he died, is that right?
I did. Yes, I interviewed him in September of 2004, and he died at the end of November. The circumstance was that his father, at the age of 6 in St. John, New Brunswick, was taken to an orphanage because his father had died at the age of 39. The mother couldn't afford to support both Frank Burton, of Pierre's father, and his brother, who was even younger, who was only about 3 or 4 years old. So she took Frank to an orphanage, to the Wiggins Male Orphans Institution, and he spent the next 10 years there. You know, he was 16 when he got out. Nobody in the Burton family knew about that, and it's rather remarkable that that should be the case, because in our day and age, there's nothing shameful about being in an orphanage. But in that time, in the late 19th century, it was, and he kept a secret all of his life, and I think it really shaped the man that Pierre Burton's father became. He was always a bit elusive. He was a wonderful father, but he was always a bit elusive and always a bit of an enigma to his son. I suppose every father is an enigma to a son, but I think it was particularly the case with Pierre, who, after all, had a nose for news. He wanted to find new things, and I think there was something that he couldn't pinpoint about his dad that he was searching for, and I think to some extent that's what drove Pierre Burton in his ambition and in his approach to things like history in the Klondike and so forth.
Well, when you read his first-hand account of himself,
yes,
as a biographer, did you find it reliable? Was he fair about himself?
Yes, I think that's a reasonable thing to say. He, every memoir or autobiography is really a series of pictures you paint for yourself about the person you want people to know about. And Pierre Burton wanted people to think that he was candid, honest, frank, outspoken, very largely like the person he was. So he made certain that the factual aspect of his autobiography was quite accurate. I don't think he did any sort of fact-checking, but his memory was excellent. And I was able to find only a half dozen things or so in which he misstated or misspoke or something. So, it's quite reliable in that respect.
There's a part in the book where you discuss that he was in Europe during the Second World War. And
he got as far as London, yes.
And he was involved with someone, and she claims that he had fathered her child.
Yes, and he writes about that in his first volume of his autobiography, starting out. He was like almost every other soldier who hadn't yet got to the continent and fighting, but was on constantly waiting, and he spent a lot of time at Aldershot and in London on leave and so forth. And like so many other men, life was short, they all thought they might die, and he had several, I wouldn't call them affairs, but sort of liaisons with young women, one of whom was a woman named Frances. That's the only name he gives, and perhaps that he knew. She was a waitress in the in an officers' association, and they had a brief affair. And as he tells the story, she announced to him that she was pregnant, but that she didn't want to have any kind of connections. It was fine. And he sort of left at that. He went back home. This is at the very end of the war. He went back home and never thought much about it again. At least that's the view he put forward.
Was he married to Janet at the time?
No, he wasn't.
He
didn't marry until after the war. Although Janet and Pierre were good friends at that time.
They met here at UBC, is that right?
Yes, they both worked for the UBC. They're both editors.
They were married for how long?
Well, I can't do the math. They were married in 1946, I believe. And so it was more than 50 years.
And what sort of marriage was it?
It was an affectionate one. It was one in which Janet Burton, who was an excellent journalist for the province, more or less gave up her employment side of a career to take care of his needs. And then she devoted herself almost entirely to her family, which ended up being six of their own children plus two that were adopted. So it was a very large and boisterous and loud family that lived out in Kleinburg. So they had a workable marriage, and from what I gather, it was a happy one.
And she's still alive, is she?
She is, yes.
She participated in this book?
Well, I interviewed her, and all of the Burtons knew I was going to write it. One of the things that I had asked Mr. Burton when I asked him, or I told him that I wanted to write a biography, is that I asked for his cooperation and that of his family. And he put out the word that that everybody should cooperate, and they did.
Elsa Franklin, she was his producer, is that right?
Yes.
And she played quite a significant role in his life. She's a chapter in your book. Just how indispensable was she to his career and his work?
Completely. There's no doubt on one hand that Pierre Burton would have been a very successful and well-known Canadian, whether or not Elsa Franklin had ever come on the scene. By the time she arrived in Toronto in the early 60s, he had already won a Governor General's Award for Klondike and was really well known in Ontario, certainly, and in British Columbia. But she became the producer of the Pierre Burton Show, which was an an interview program that went from 1962 to really about 1973. They went around the world interviewing just about everybody you could possibly imagine from the 60s and early 70s. And she was the driving force of that program. She also took a man who was very awkward and gangly and ill-coordinated, didn't have any dress sense in front of a camera or in general, and she completely remade him as far as his how he wore his hair, the kind of clothes he wore, the way he should speak. She completely shaped the image we came to have of Pierre Burton. So she was an absolutely vital part of his career.
In that chapter, it's called The Elsa Factor. You talk about the Swordsman Club.
Yeah.
And people can read, people have read about it already in the press, and they can read about it in the book. It's a club, a social club of gentlemen who partied or had lunch with ladies who weren't necessarily their wives.
Right.
At the end of that chapter, you ask Elsa Franklin if she'd slept with Pierre Burton. Her answer was, "I'm not going to answer that question." What did you make of that? What do you read into that, I guess?
I read into it confirmation that very likely they had a long-term intimate relationship. But having said that, I accept her explanation that, in a way, there's no point in her answering the question because she can't win either way or the other. If she denies it, people will shrug their shoulders and look suspicious or skeptical. And if she admitted that she had an affair with him, then it could damage relations with the family, and it's a very sensitive subject.
Let's talk about the books now. The National Dream and The Last Spike. These are perhaps his lasting achievements, are they not?
Yes, I think those probably are among his best.
Well, why do you think they struck a chord with Canadians at the time they were published? This would have been the late 60s, early 70s, right?
1970 was The National Dream, and 71 was The Last Spike. Well, I spent a lot of time charting the rise of Burton to fame and ultimately to iconic status, largely by looking at the way his books are received and reviewed. And one of the things that emerged as a whole, right from his earliest book, The Mysterious North, for which he won his first Governor General's Award, that was in 1956, right through to his last major book, I would say The Arctic Grail in the late 1980s, one of the themes that unites all that is that he was able to tap into the fears and the desires of Canadians at exactly the right moment with respect to his books. So, for example, when John Diefenbaker is talking about his northern vision, that's when Klondike comes out, and it taps into the idea of this new north, the north suddenly is sexy. Likewise with the National Dream. In the early 70s, 1970s, was a time when there was a lot of desire on the part of Canadians to do new and wonderful things. These were the immediate post-Expo years. And yet there was a lot of fear and trepidation that we couldn't do it. There was a recession in the early 1970s, a whole variety of anxieties that people had. Can we build the new Canada, the modern Canada, and the just society? Well, what Burton does with The National Dream is he looks at the 1870s, and he shows the way in which all of the same problems existed. Political corruption, a big recession, an absence of enough money to do national things, a whole variety of things. And the National Dream is about the attempt to build this railway. The railway isn't even off the ground in the book. It's really finding the ways to get things done. So at the end of that book, the reader takes away a certain knowledge of Canadian history, but basically the message that 1970s Canadians took away from it was that we have the capability of doing a great national thing if we only get down to it. After all, a century earlier, they did that. And then, of course, the next year, when the Last Spike is published, the message of that book is, you see, I told you we could do it. We built the National Dream.
Well, was this by accident, or was this by concerted design on his part?
He had a nose for news. He was very prescient about a lot of things. So it wasn't a kind of calculated plan that he had to do these things. He was simply very often the right person at the right time. So it had the net effect of allaying people's fears or feeding into their dreams. But it was just his nose for the important thing to do or the important thing to write. Just think, at the end of the 1980s, in 1988, what is the big issue? It's federal election day, year, and the big issue is Arctic sovereignty and free trade. Well, what book comes out? It's the Arctic Grail. Now, Burton wasn't planning that. It was just his project. He couldn't have predicted there would be an election over Arctic sovereignty and free trade. But what he writes about is foreigners, both British and American, who explore and attempt to gain control over Canadian land. And he basically argues that, you know, these American adventurers and these fools like Franklin, who wouldn't even accommodate himself to the Eskimo in order to survive, that these people are not the kind of people who should be developing Canada. We should be developing Canada. We should be protecting our resources. We should, that of course played into the anti-free trade thing. So I could take other books like that. He just happens to write the right book at the right time. And, you know, Fear and Desire is the very center of all advertising, isn't it?
It is.
What he did was he plugged into Canadians at a deep emotional level. They may not have liked him, they may have thought of him as arrogant, but at a certain point in his career, his image gained a kind of moral resonance. He was the consumer crusader, he was the protector of our identity, and so forth. And that's exactly what a brand needs in order to become iconic. It has to have an emotional connection with the purchaser or the consumer.
He received a lot of criticism as a historian. Jack Granitstein was perhaps the most vocal, most visible. You're a historian yourself, Professor McKillop. How would you regard Burton's work critically?
Historically, it's factually accurate more often than it isn't. It's out of date in the style, in the sense that most writers don't write a kind of romantic narrative of the sort that he did. He wrote very episodic, anecdotal things. You know, he always wanted to grab your attention, and that sort of drives academic historians crazy because they look at themes and concepts and theories. But I think the tide has turned a little bit because academic audiences have shrunk as academics of my generation abandoned storytelling as a fundamental thing about history. And I think there has been a whole movement back toward the idea of historical narrative as telling some kind of story. There's no misfit between narrative and storytelling and analysis. That's the way the argument is largely put. Well, you're not being analytical because you're telling a story. Well, that's baloney. Just read the new biography of Champlain, for example. It's wonderful, by a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian. I mean, nobody would argue that that's not profoundly analytical in its own way, but it's a great biography. So I think Burton's kind of storytelling may come back in a certain way, perhaps not in a romantic way, but just look at the trajectory of Jack Granitstein himself. He now writes popular history. He abandoned overly academic approaches to things. And in the year that Pierre Burton died, in fact, a week before, it was Jack Granitstein that won the Pierre Burton Award.
Ed, Burton is a nationalist, a Canadian nationalist. You describe this in the book as the Canadian moment between the late 60s and the early 80s. What is the Canadian moment?
Well, at the moment, it's a kind of a shorthand fiction of mine to try to grasp that special decade and a half or so, somewhere between the mid-60s and the early 80s, when there was a period in which Canadians had a largeness of vision, who they thought that their country was larger than the sum of its parts. They were proud about the social achievements and the social welfare, or the social system we had created. And prior to that, prior to, say, the early 60s, we were pretty much in, had a kind of sense of inferiority. We were colonial. We were very much in the British grasp. And after the mid-80s, we were very much in the American and globalization moment. But during, in that first 15 or so years, Burton, Atwood, and a bunch of others put together a kind of literary and cultural renaissance in Canada that is still very much with us. I mean, we may live in times that we think are diminished times, diminished expectations, diminished vision. We have a, or at least today we have a prime minister, I think everybody would argue, believes that Canada is somehow less than the sum of its parts, that government really ought to do as little as possible. That was the antithesis of Burton's generation. That was the antithesis of the Canadian moment. And if we didn't have the kind of secure national identity or identities that that generation, that 15 years, brought, we would be in really deep trouble when we have the kind of small politicians that we currently have.
Is that Burton's legacy then?
I think to the extent that he was the spokesperson of that generation, I think that very largely is so. And it's interesting, the kind of, we're not seeing these days the criticism of necessary government regulation and protection that has been criticized for the last 30 years by advocates of globalization. Why? Because we've seen what happened when absolute deregulation began to take hold, catastrophe or near it. So I think it's not beyond possibility that we're going to see in Canada and elsewhere a return to some kind of balance between governments which actually govern actively for all people and not simply for the economic markets. And I think that's an entirely a legacy of the Burton generation.
Having spent time with him near the end of his life and researching his life and career, do you get a sense that he enjoyed it, that he enjoyed his life, he enjoyed his career?
Absolutely, yes. Right to his final days, I think he thought he had gotten as much out of life as he possibly could have squeezed out of it. And I think that to some extent was the case from the time he was a very small boy. Remember, he lived in a ghost town. Every moment of the first 11 years of his life, his town got more and more decrepit. Things burnt down, they fell apart, whatever. So he had a real sense of the fragility of life. Anything could disappear. Anything could go away. Everything could be destroyed. And I think he went out of his way as soon as he got out of the North, from the time he hit Victoria, that he was going to experience as much of it as soon as he could, and he did.
And the reaction from the family has been what?
I don't know, frankly, because I haven't spoken to any members of the family, certainly since the book was published. It was only published officially today. So I don't know. I would like to think that while there might be some parts of the book that they would perhaps, I hadn't treated his private life, for example, that I'd like them to think that I have done my best to produce a book that is worthy of him.
And it is a highly readable book, Professor MacKillop. I thank you for joining us today. Congratulations on a very fine service.
Thank you very much.
Continued good luck with the book. The book is called Pierre Burton, A Biography, published by McClelland & Stewart, $37.99. For the commentary, I'm Joseph Plenum.